instructor got international travel. I didn't get to do it. But I came to really not like the job, but my purpose was I learned a lot. I gained a lot of really strong administrative skills. And as I said to my Polish refugee director, my goal is to outlive you. Which I did. He retired. I would say, wake, come in every morning and go, Henry, when will you retire? So that was I got the decent salary, I got my benefits, I got my retirement benefits, and the program was, as Henry, the Polish refugee, used to say, this is Soviet. The sooner system is Soviet. And indeed it was. And this was like an entrepreneurial program. People paid to have immersion in a language with people who were native speakers, and we offered six different levels. But the university system couldn't deal with something that wasn't like, what do you mean your students aren't going to fill out this questionnaire about their ethnic background? And so for our data sets, and what do you mean that your money is not going to flow through our system? And what do you mean the bureaucracy couldn't deal with, it was a square peg in a round hole. And eventually it closed, which turned out to be very good for me. Because I was to replace that job, because at this point I'm tenured, I was offered two jobs part-time. One was with the museum, the Dorsky Museum on campus, and the other was with a little Hudson Valley think tank called the Benjamin Center. So I got to actually where previously, with Language Immersion Institute, it was entirely administrative. And here's the other thing. I mean, I really had to leave the field. It's not like I could go to folklore meetings anymore or serve on a board anymore. When I was at SUNY New Paltz, I didn't have the kind of job where I had any freedom whatsoever. My time was set. I had to be there. There was no not being there. So there was no flexibility. And I missed that a lot. And I missed doing projects until finally I got the Benjamin Center job and the Dorsky job when they closed language immersion, where I got to do both of those things and do administrative stuff. So I ended my career there better off than when I started. I don't know if we're talking that much about folklore. We're only talking about me. So during this is a little embarrassing. Let's see. So New York folklore. I went to the attic, and let me pull up your questions here.
Oh yeah, I forgot that we're
Yeah.
in the package. Yeah.
So, okay. How did I get involved with New York folklore? I think that all the folklorists in New York State were involved with New York folklore. You asked me about being on the board of New York folklore, and I read that question and I said, I was on the board of New York folklore. I mean, I had no memory of this whatsoever. I did remember this. And it had to be early on because I came to New York in 1985 and left the field in 1996. So it had to be early on, like late 80s, and that I was on the board. And I remember probably the first meeting that I was at. And I believe that it was at Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimlet's loft in Manhattan. And she was a board member and a professor at NYU. And I think that she She created the performance studies program at NYU. Anyway, I think it was at her loft. And I remember saying to someone afterwards, as we were leaving, as the meeting broke up, we're folklorists. We have a meeting, we're having a meeting on Super Bowl Sunday. We're into ritual, we're into pageantry, we're into games. And yet, here it is, Super Bowl Sunday, one of the most important days in American culture, but we're having a meeting. So that was a little joke, but also true. And we always had our annual meeting smack in the middle of the World Series. I'm a baseball fan, not a football fan, but I do watch the Super Bowl. Anyway, that's what I remember about being a board member at New York Folklore. And then Robert Barron, who was the director of the Folk Arts program at the New York State Council on the Arts, after that meeting said to me, Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimlet said to me that he said that I seem thoughtful. And I said, well, I didn't say anything, so I guess I'm thoughtful. So that's all I remember about being a board member of the New York Folklore Society. Though I did find minutes to a meeting where I'm listed as absent and was reminded that there were two meetings a year, so it wasn't like, you know, heavy duty work or anything. One was wherever, somewhere in the state, because things moved around the state because everybody was spread out. And one was at annually at the New York State, the New York Folk Arts Roundtable, which is something that Robert Barron, which I think is still going on, created. And once a year, everybody would meet in Syracuse and talk about what we were doing, issues in the field, whatever. Professional development meeting. And it was always a weekend in Syracuse and always a lot of fun. So there was also a New York Folklore Society board meeting there, though I don't remember any of them. And I found a bunch of New York Folklore newsletters. So I replaced Dan Ward, who was a folklorist in Syracuse. I replaced him as newsletter editor, and I have some of the newsletters that he edited, and then I have a bunch of newsletters that I was the editor for. And I recall that often getting people to write stuff was like pulling teeth. Oh my God. Oh yeah, sure, I'll write that. And then you're at the deadline. He's like, where is it? And then you'd end up writing stuff yourself because they just didn't do it. But one thing I recall is that Dan worked with a printer in Syracuse. And John Souter became the director of New York Folklore, and he was in Ithaca. So when I became the editor of the newsletter, I said to John, let's move the printing to my neighborhood, the printing and design to my neighborhood. And John said, no. So that was that. And so it turned out that Dan would do his own layup of the newsletter. And it, you know, it was, I guess it was okay for the time. And I mean, because this is pre, like, you didn't have Publisher or InDesign or any of that stuff. So it was really manual layup. So that now came to me, which wasn't too bad because my husband was a graphic designer, but it wasn't a great looking publication. It was like a high school newsletter publication. So, eventually, oh, this happened. I'm going to conflate two things. But eventually, John Souter said, look, I'm going to take over. I'm going to get a designer and I'm going to have it printed here in Ithaca, which it's just so much better what the design that was eventually came to be and that process. And I do recall. I only tell you bad things because I think they're funny. But someone in upstate New York had sent me a booklet of a project they had done I can't remember what the project was, but this was like a 30-page booklet, which began with prehistoric Indians in upstate New York. And I was to pare this down and make it like a 1,000-word essay in a newsletter. I should have told him to do it, but I didn't. So, but I hacked out all the stuff about prehistory, and I kept only the contemporary piece of it, and I wrote an essay based on it. Well, whoever this person was, I don't remember, calls up John Souter, is livid that I had edited him. Well, don't send me a 30-page booklet and expect it. So he's was livid. And John calls me and says, this guy's upset. And I said, tell him I've got testosterone in my body. I could be a prick too. So, anyway, there was that. Anyway, John is the one who transformed the newsletter. And then at another meeting in which I was absent, a New York Folklore Society meeting, and I only remember this because I wasn't there, because John said to, I was told by people that when the new newsletter came out and John was talking about it, and it got a standing ovation, and John gave me credit. I didn't deserve any of the credit, so I didn't tell anyone that, but it was John Souter who did it. It wasn't me. So when I left, it was one of the things I had to quit was the New York Folklore Newsletter, and I really liked the way Karen Taussig-Lux, who now lives in Pennsylvania or has for many years, wrote. I mean, completely, utterly. If you ever want to read a dissertation that is, it's just perfection and completely egoless writing. There is, it's just perfection. So I urged John to hire Karen to replace me, which he did at $30,000 a year. I made, if I remember correctly, $500 an issue. Right. And then I walked the road again. John calls up and says, I found this entire collection of New York folklore journals. Will you do a Catskill regional book from essays in the journal essays that are pertain to the Catskills? Well, I'd lived here already for a long time, so I knew a lot of the essays, and I put it together in probably 10 days. And we had a local publisher, Ray Rominger, Purple Mountain Press. And I believe that I got $500 for that, and then a promise of $500 in royalties when they came as they came in. So I got $1,000 to do this. So nobody else would work for as cheap as me. I was dumb. So anyway, that was a fun project. My only regret with that is that I didn't put in any of Herb Helfrecht's essays, and I really, really should have. I feel bad about that. Herb Helfrecht was a local legend, basically, who was a musicologist, and he had been the editor of Sing Out Music, Sing Out magazine forever, and he ran with Norm Studer, who was the founder of the Little Red Schoolhouse in the Village in Manhattan. They had run Camp Woodland, which was basically a commie camp for kids in the Catskills. So I'm sorry, I didn't leave him out of the book, but I did leave his essays out, and I really shouldn't have, and I regret that. So that's that story. Tell me when you're getting bored. So I've told you about my experience in the board. I told you I don't have no memory. The Earp Center, Staten Island. Tell me how you balance these careers. It wasn't a balance. It was literally cobbling together a living, doing all these projects. And as I became more comfortable in the field, I started creating the projects. I would devise the projects rather than having somebody call me up and say, "Hey, we need somebody to do this." So things like the Irish Music Festival or the Watershed Exhibition or the Farm Stand Exhibition or the Ethnic Resorts of the Catskills, those were all generated by me or me and a colleague. We were really doing things we were interested in, and it was just really fulfilling work, if only it had paid. Let's see.
Actually, I wanted to ask just to clarify because we may have skipped over or went over it, but I don't remember how I caught it. How did you get involved with New York Folklore Society?
Oh, I think that everybody was. I mean, they must have asked me, and I think that at some point, pretty much everybody in the field passed through the board of the New York Folklore Society. So when I look at the minutes that I found at one meeting, it's like all the newbies in New York, because the way Robert Barron had set up folk arts in New York State was first in the 70s, the NEA Folk Arts Program was funded. The NEA funneled money into state folk arts programs through their arts councils. And the way Robert chose to do to take his, use his money was to devolve it down to counties in New York State. So whereas some people who were state folklorists would do their own projects and then just hire consultants to do little things, he created positions throughout New York State for folklorists, which was really a great thing to do. And so people moved in and out of the state all the time, mostly in, because there were jobs here for folklorists. And that's those are job and folklorist are those are oxymorons. They don't belong in the same sentence. So it was a place to work. And I can't I, somebody asked me. I was a new girl in town. I'd been here a year or two. Somebody asked me to be on the board because everybody at some point was on that board. So, and you do term, there are term limits, and you get the next schmo folklorist from wherever. I think that's how it happened. Ellen McHale will know better. And at the time, I forget who was the director of New York Folklore. I mean, it might have, it previously it was just an academic journal, and it was, it had a board and there wasn't like a staff. So I don't know when they started becoming a real organization, but it had to involve NISCA money from Robert Barron. So I worked with John Souter. I don't know if there was a director prior to John Souter. I don't recall. But whoever, there might have been, but whoever was the director, that's where the New York Folklore Society moved until Ellen McHale got the job or and created a permanent home in Schenectady, which is a good place. It's kind of centrally located. It's a neat little city. But whoever was the director, that was the address of the New York Folklore Society until Ellen. So I don't know how I got involved in New York folklore, except that everybody was involved in New York folklore. Everybody was a member. And they're, bottom line is they're not that many working folklorists. There are a lot of people interested in folklore. And people actually, in fact, I found the agendas for two annual meetings of the New York Folklore Society, one in the Adirondacks, and one that I helped produce, which was Mary Zwolinski and I, which was about ethnic resorts in the Catskills, because we had done that big project on ethnic resorts in the Catskills. And that took place in Durham and in Round Top, which is the German Catskills. I forget where we stayed. But probably at one of the Italian places in Tannersville. So I have those to send as part of this, some of those annual meeting notes. And I remember going to one up in the not the Finger Lakes, on the St. Lawrence River. That might have been the Sagamore one. But it was great. People would bring their families. They were always destinations, the annual meetings, that were a lot of fun. And I guess we had a meeting where people elected, were elected to positions, and but nobody cared about that. There were bars available, so right. I think we covered all your questions.
I'm sure it's the majority of the ones that I had written down.
So, so many things are not. Oh, I have a funny story. When I left the Staten Island Council on the Arts and then was working at the, I told you that these organizations were always on the verge of collapse. I got a call from the FBI about the Staten Island Council on the Arts. Apparently, the director, Mary Lee O'Neill, was in the wind. And there was a lot of money missing. I mean, a gigantic budget deficit. And the FBI wanted to know if I knew where that money was and where Mary Lee O'Neill was. No, sir, I sure don't. But it was like that. So I think Staten Island Council on the Arts still exists, but I mean, she was doing things like she hired Richard Bruno, who was worked for Bess Meyerson. She was like in New York State cultural affairs. He was like the New York City cultural affairs. He lost his job, and she gave him a no-show job. I mean, he did nothing. He just to pay his rent, just enough to cover his rent, because so it was shit like that going on on Staten Island. And the Staten Island and the Schoharie County Council on the Arts just closed. It doesn't exist anymore, as far I don't think it does. The Earp Center was eventually absorbed by the Catskill Center. I was on the board of that organization when this happened, and I didn't want it to happen. It housed in the same building, but I said, I don't want this to happen because, and but it happened anyway, because who am I? And at the they signed this contract with the Catskill Center, and I said, what we've done here is give the director a job for 1 year. And sure as shit, 1 year later, she's fired. So the Earp Center is, I mean, and they had people do little exhibitions here and there, but there's, nothing going on there anymore. And since COVID, I don't think anybody even goes to work in that building. Everybody's still working remotely. Anyway, that's that story. So these organizations were really kind of on shaky ground. They were seat of your pants, organizations. And not all of them, because obviously Steve Zeitlin's done a bang-up job with city lore. The New York folklore is obviously stable. They have a folklorist at in the Hudson Valley, but all, part time. I don't know how people make a living. I really don't. I just, it's beyond me. So I think there was some resentment that I just completely disappeared from the field, and I'm a lot of, and I did, but I just wasn't in a position to continue because I was, you know, driving 60 miles to work, working for, you know, 8, 9 hours, driving back, and I didn't have any kind of flexibility until they closed the damn language school, and then I did. Then it was like, oh, so Becky Miller wants you to do a presentation in her fieldwork class. Yeah, go ahead. But that was different. So it was like, you know, years before I was able to do that again. That's so not interesting to you. I hope you get a real job. Go for that. But it was hard for me. I mean, I started out saying I grew up in a working class family and I was really, you know, taken with Studs Terkel's working. And I really felt like, I mean, the aspiration for my parents was that I would be a middle class person. And I just wasn't cutting it in being a folklorist. I mean, I have a sister who's a New York State Supreme Court judge. I have a sister who was a principal of Bronxville Middle School. I had to do something. So to fulfill my parents' first generation dream for their children. And here I am, retired with health insurance. That's my whole story.
And I think at this point we are closing in on that hour mark anyway.
We are.
So I
It was a
suppose,
pleasure meeting you.
in that case, I would, well, thank you for your time. I know I probably didn't get to ask.